You want to hear the worst joke ever that I know?
Go for it.
Okay, well, you're gonna have to bleep a word. Knock, knock.
Did I do it
No.
wrong? Okay,
Yeah.
do it again.
Knock,
Okay, no.
knock, knock.
Who's there? I'll bleep that word. Pussy who? Pussycat who? Pussy willow who?
You're supposed to go, I don't get it.
Oh,
And then
that's the
I
whole
say,
joke?
I know. Sorry.
It's funny because it's true.
You're gonna have to bleep that whole thing. Okay, yeah, we're back. Okay, so welcome back to the ad brief together with Noam Rosenberg, Oscar Epling, sitting sort of across each other, watching each other. He's drinking beer, dudes. And here we're recording the ad brief podcast on April Fool's Day, actually, but this isn't a joke. This is very serious.
It's because they're not going to be hearing it on April Fool's Day.
Right.
So it will no longer be a joke. Anything we say won't be funny.
Serious. We never crack jokes. That's the thing. We're never sarcastic and we don't have quips and we're always very, very serious. So what kind of beer is that? I see a black and red can and you tell me it has no calories. Does it get you drunk?
It's a Budweiser Select and we just finished the website for it. So when this podcast comes out, that'll be live. And we worked on that with an agency here in town, Cannonball, which was a lot of fun. So this is kind of our celebratory beer, I guess. And the team's still behind me finishing up.
Oh, all right. I thought they paid you in beers because, you know, that seems to be the normal par for the course. You know, we barter. We don't get paid in advertising. People just give other people stuff. Like today, our big story is about – or big story. Today, the story that's not an April Fool's joke is about Artist versus American Eagle. And the reason that thing even happened was because American Eagle gave an up-and-coming band – some billboard space, and they put up this idea that they developed via Giant Day in New York, artist versus artist. So you could choose your side for piracy or anti-piracy, and you tweet on that, and that's collected in a web page and the usual. And so, well, some artists got kind of ticked off by that, and they copied that to do artist versus American Eagle, suggesting we should all shoplift at American Eagle and that sort of thing, which is kind of funny. So it's appropriate that it comes out today because I think a funny takedown.
Yeah,
but it's not an April Fool's joke. They're seriously not so happy.
What happens if an honestly absurd thing happens on April 1st?
Yeah, I guess nobody believes it until the next day. You know it's Adlan's birthday, the April 1st.
Oh really? How many is it this year? I didn't know that.
It's 18. Adlan can have a beer in certain countries in Europe now.
Is this for real or is this an April Fool's joke?
No, this is for real.
Has it been that long? Wow, 18 years.
That makes me feel so old. if I had had a baby, I didn't. I just had a website, you know. But
the website still cries when it needs a nap.
Yeah. The website needs more attention than babies. Seriously.
Probably. So speaking of, one of the things we were going to talk about is arrogant students.
Yeah, that was it.
The funny segue.
Well, because we were talking about self-promotion earlier, and in self-promotion, there's a lot of students doing self-promotion, and that's fun. And I look at those because they're interesting in many ways, but sometimes the students forget what they're actually selling about themselves, like whether they're a good writer or if they're, you know, if they're consumptually thinking or something. And the worst was when we saw kind of a lame self-promotion idea that linked not to a portfolio at all. So then it was like, well, really, you have to actually make the portfolio first, and then the self-promotion is the cherry on top that leads us to your portfolio if you're having trouble getting in. So it's interesting to me how many self-promotion students have to come up with, and some of them are good and a lot of them are absolute rubbish, and it says a lot about them. So you got to be careful with those.
Yeah. Well, I think the people who have just that great promo like you're talking about probably are afraid of their book, you know, or feel like they're insecure about what's in their book. So they're going to make something to get noticed. And then, oh yeah, by the way, here's a bunch of crappy work.
Yeah, exactly. And that can honestly backfire. I heard a story. This is like, you know, a prehistoric story from a long time ago. But John Hegarty was being chased by a young student who really, really wanted to get in there, and she really wanted to show her portfolio to him. And she'd been calling and bugging and sending little things and booklets and all sorts for at least 9 months. And that's when it suddenly hits her that she's been doing this. She's been calling practically every week for 9 months, right? And she's always bumped to call back next week. So finally, she just runs into the office with a pillow under her shirt and says, you know, John said... And he hasn't called back. And it's been like forever. And the person who's been taking her call for 9 months realizes, it's like, oh my God, there's a pregnant woman here. So she gets her into John. And so she says to him, I got good news and I got bad news. The good news is, and then she pulls out the pillow, I'm not pregnant. Because he's trying to figure this out. You know, he's trying to figure out, what did I do 9 months ago? Why is this here? What? So she's like, well, I'm not pregnant, so that's not real. But here, you have to look at my portfolio, which he did. So he spent time looking at her portfolio. And he's the one who told me the story. And he says the problem was her portfolio did not hold up to the level of the stunt.
Right.
So he didn't. But he was like, you know, genuinely intrigued after she got into his office with that stunt. He was like, maybe this girl knows what she's doing. And then the portfolio just wasn't good enough.
Right, like if her portfolio was other guerrilla work and that's just the way she thought or approached it, that's fine. If the portfolio, if she's an art director, you know, and it didn't have any of that kind of, or what if she was account service and she did that? As long as the promotion isn't delivering on what she was trying to sell, I guess.
Wasn't as creative as that work. And yeah, there's a lot, we see a lot of mistakes. So some students are just arrogant in their approach. And there's a lot of arrogant students out there who miss out on learning from other people because they simply think they're too good to listen.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and do you recognize that? You've seen that?
Well, you know, definitely. So at prior jobs, we hired mostly out of ad school. And so of course, if you're already, you know, into the mythology of yourself and then you go and spend another 50 grand on it, that's just going to make it worse. So not saying that everybody from ad schools were arrogant, but it's just the ones who were arrogant and went to ad school were triply so.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a conversation with a guy about 2 weeks ago talking about he's really into SEO, search engine mm-hmm. stuff. And when he goes into a meeting with the client, there's the brand guy and then him. And, you know, the client's listening to him sometimes and that freaks out the brand guys. And we kind of got to this core that, you know, even still now in the days of online stuff and more reasonable metrics and things that we can kind of see where our ad budgets are going, these guys who are in charge of big brand stuff, TV, radio, whatever, the big awareness stuff that we're having a really hard time measuring are kind of swamis. They're sort of tied into the idea that this work is good because those people, those creators have some inherent ability to make magical work, right? And don't question mm-hmm. it. We have 20 years experience, so we must be right. And we can't prove it, but don't try to prove it. And if you do try and prove it, you're kind of wrong, even just trying. And I think these arrogant students are kind of like trying to put that on or communicate that, like that they have some latent ability.
Yeah.
And you can't question it. You know, you can't write it. It's almost like the ability to hit home runs all the time or something. Who knows what that is? But yeah. I don't think that really relates in advertising. I think the skills that I've seen in people that really make them successful are self-promotion and the ability to kind of be in the right place in the right time, which is a skill. And to not put up with crap or to foresee situations that are going to be crap. Like, you know, I think we've all worked with those people that just always seem to be on the good account. And we all go, well, you know, their headlines are a sentence long and mine are a sentence long. Maybe they're better or not. I don't think anybody has the metric to really say the difference between a really good headline and a great headline. We just go by gut and can be wrong. But man, those people seem to always get the cherry assignments and ride the right stuff up to the top, you know? Go ahead.
Yeah, there's some people who are so skilled for that they keep failing upward as well. I mean, they right. Everything they touched failed, but they still get hired and on a higher level. I'm like, I'm fascinated by those people.
Well, they must be good at something. You know, they're not necessarily good at making stuff, but they're good at managing their managers.
I don't know. Usually they have a brown nose.
Is that a skill?
I think it's a skill.
It's a skill, but it's not a trade. I don't think you can get
I mean,
paid good
you
for
can
that.
also see it by, you know, if you start looking at the real high levels of brass people and where they're going, you know, and you see like large accounts have bounced out of an agency, it's been bleeding forever. And then suddenly, you know, the guy who's basically was the person in charge of all this with the large accounts disappearing, he now has, you know, they've leveled him up to global, worldwide, something or other, majestic unicorn. And that sort of means we're putting you in the corner office. You have no power, but here's a salary. Shut up.
Hey, that's a pretty good deal.
I'd
take that deal, yeah. Along the lines of arrogance, one of the other things that we want to talk about that is the this idea where the ad agencies always need to sort of take on the voice of the brand in these manifestos.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My manifesto pages that I did together with Kid Sleepy on Adland. It's at adlandtv.com/manifestos if you missed it. And warning, there's autoplay. The whole idea of that manifesto generator was that it would give you a generic manifesto for various products and stuff, and we picked the perfect song for each one. And there's exactly two people who immediately said, God, it's got autoplay. Autoplay is bad. And it's like, whoo, you just hear the point flying across their heads, and they've missed it completely.
Yeah.
And then one of them was picking on, she said there's typos in it. And I was like, okay, where? And then she picked one of the ones that I had written. And she said, well, there's a T-O where there should be a T-W-O. And it's like, no, I'm actually spelling the word two, not the number two. So that's not a typo.
It was an incorrect grammatical correction.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, people really want to like, it's meant to be a joke. We had so much fun and we were giggling so hard when we were writing those. It was ridiculous. We just got fed up. Every single ad that was coming in for like 2 weeks was a manifesto. It's like, okay, we're done now. We have to stop it.
Isn't the manifesto like sort of the agency's chance to show off without there being a real brief?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the thing. And it's a problem too, because like Wyden and Kennedy has become like manifesting that, but seriously, it's just manifesto after manifesto recently, and it's just like we have to stop doing that.
Yeah, it's like they want it to feel epic, but then somehow the only thing that we've seen in the ad role that feels epic are always manifestos. Like they kind of can't move off of it. It's always some variation of the, like George Washington on a horse giving an amazing speech. It's always got this huge, like, rally the troops kind of vibe to it that when the times that I've worked on them, so, you know, by my trade, I'm not a writer either. And so I've worked with a lot of writers, and I always felt like it was their chance to kind of grab the reins on a project because it's all prose. It's all copy. And it's the manifestos all seem to live in this, like, dream world where ads work and people love them. And the things that you wrote in that page are really going to convince somebody of something. And it's kind of this whole big you know, maybe all of advertising is a small fiction because we're all kind of pretending that all this stuff really, really works as much as we say it does. And then within that, the manifesto is like the big dream. And it's like this perfect world where ad people are rock stars and the brand is the most important thing in people's lives. And this copy is so perfectly crystallizing it, you know, it's their Oscar winning moment of their career.
Yeah. The thing about manifestos is as much as we can be tired of them, I think they very often work for the punter. They're watching TV and they get a little verklempt, you know.
Yeah.
It's like
I was surprised that the Super Bowl, the spots that people really non-ad people really liked, felt like, you know, okay, everybody get your hankies now. We're all going to start crying. You know, it just kind of felt like it was the crying moment. You were set up for it. It hit all the notes of it. And so to me, I was kind of, you know, in that sense, it lacked unexpectedness. And I was kind of surprised that so many people would say it was their favorite. People like, I guess, sad stuff.
Emotion is a really difficult stuff, but if you get it right, you will have found a little small spot in the heart of people.
Yeah.
And so tagging along to emotions when you're shilling something is actually quite a clever move. I mean, I still don't understand why the Clydesdales works for beer, but I have been absolutely fascinated by them since I was a kid. When I was a kid, I really loved them. And as an adult, I am a beer drinker, but however, I do not drink Budweiser, so I think they failed there.
Well, I can tell you, living here in St. Louis, I know why they work, because there's this place called Grant's Farm that the Bush family used to own, I guess they still own, but it, you know, it used to, it's a free amusement park basically, and the Clydesdales live there. And you know, they I guess used to take them through the city, and the Clydesdales would be pulling beer around. Love animals, and they're like really specific looking animals. But like, if you think back, like, how do you even explain how Clydesdales became equivalent to beer, other
Yeah.
than repetition, I guess. You know, if you don't live here, but.
Yeah, but to me, you know, when I was a little older, I was thinking, gee, did they put those Clydesdales there so that I would actually fancy it as a kid? You know how they lure you in as a child, you know, with the you're going through the supermarket with your mom and you're nagging her to get that the soapy scrubby bubble stuff for the bathroom because, you know, they have the bubbles and you've seen the animation and it's like you want that. And your mom is like trying to explain to you for the 500th time that, you know, she doesn't use that because it's full of chemicals or something.
Do you remember Hamm's beer? Do you
Oh,
remember
with
Hamm's
the
beer?
was that the one with the bear? The
Yeah.
yeah,
It
yes,
was
I
like
do.
it was basically like
Yeah, it was basically Yogi Bear.
Yogi Bear. And he would come down a mountain, and he would be, you know, he just, it was like it came on in Saturday morning cartoons, I think. I remember thinking it was one of my things. You know, when you're a kid, you have like your five shows, and that was it. And I remember thinking it was totally was for kids. I know they've gotten they've had to change a lot of that stuff now. I don't know how intentional it was,
Oh,
but.
I think Ham actually went under because I wrote about it, but.
I can say though, you know, I've worked on a lot of products that are targeted to adults. I've worked on a lot of products in categories that people say use subliminal stuff. Like I've done tobacco and working on beer. And everybody is actually really careful to make sure that stuff is targeted to adults. People are really careful to make sure all the warnings are on stuff, that we're putting, you know, age gates on stuff. And it's kind of interesting to me to see, and I guess I'm kind of in my heart kind of an anti-corporate guy too, so I get where people are coming from, that you expect, you know, that businesses are always have something up their sleeve because we've been tricked enough times maybe. But in that category, I have been kind of surprised that nobody, I've never seen anything happen sort of below board, as far as, you know, tricking people into wanting something that they didn't want.
Yeah, no, I've worked on it's a million years ago. I worked on Benson and Hedges for a brief moment in time, and just going through the rules of Benson and Hedges in the UK, it was really, really funny because I couldn't have a glass with an ice cube in it on a table near this Benson and Hedges because the ice cube is water and water implies purity and cigarettes are not pure. So there can't be, yeah, you can't have rain, you can't have puddles, you can't have anything that has to do with water. So that got really interesting. And so, of course, the British solution to advertising tobacco was to get really surreal. And that's why the Benson and Hedges and the, you know, all these other campaigns that came out for a while were really surreal and excellent.
Or more interesting at least, right?
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is, I think, especially with something like cigarettes and to some degree beer, but not quite as much. They're almost the same. It's hard to tell the difference between a Benson Hedges and a Marlboro, you know, if unless you really know the flavor. And so you get better advertising there because what else, when you're buying it, you're buying advertising, right? You're buying the brand, you're buying the myth that surrounds it. Actually, speaking of students, I forgot about this until I went and talked to some kids at a college last week. They were all very nice. Nobody was arrogant, but it was a PR class up at Principia College, which is on this gorgeous, like, pastoral. It overlooks the Mississippi, but it's like the nice part of the Mississippi, not industrial at all. And but it's only like 20 minutes from downtown. It's crazy. So anyway, I was had to give a talk about branding, and one of the things that came to mind was I got my own deodorant out of my closet, and I had a Speed Stick and I had an Old Spice, which are, you know, identical products, same ingredients, everything, but so much of the differentiation is just in the brand, and it's with products like that where you can really see the difference coming through. You know, these
Yeah.
so-called like parody products like cigarettes or whatever. So like the surreal ads you're talking about for cigarettes, that's actually kind of a great solution or a great place to look for that more creative advertising, because you can't, there is no product difference
Yeah.
that
No,
you can
it's
really
that
talk about.
that's the same thing. I mean, basically the sugar flavored waters as well. There's not much of a USP going on in the brown bubbly stuff versus the see-through bubbly stuff. They're tasted practically the same. So those are always interesting too. I mean, certain soda pop campaigns in I know a lot of people don't say soda pop, but I don't care. It's pop. It's soda pop. So you could have like, you know, they had a campaign for Tango Citrus or something. I don't know which flavor it was. It was one of the Tango flavors where it was like, you naughty little minx. It was like this naughty, sexy can that used to call up this guy at the office and drive him insane. And it was just like, that's nuts. You have this soda pop calling up a guy in the office. I love that stuff. I mean, it's much better than, you know, everybody's on a mountain and teaching the world to sing. Or yeah, we were talking about the social media of certain Coke specifically brands, but soda pop brands and social media. I mean, everybody knows the soda pop brands. Do they gain anything by having a Twitter account and talking to people?
Yeah, I just saw that article. They were saying that I've seen two spins put on that article. So basically, Coke revealed, right, if this is the same one, that they what is it like, they can't draw a line between a specific post and sales, right? So that wasn't that what they were saying? So that Coke has more fans than anybody on Facebook, but they don't necessarily know if that translates to more sales or not. Which some people interpret it as saying Facebook doesn't work.
Yeah, and at the same time, there was something in there where they said they could track specific sales to specific social media things, you know, in a closed loop circuit. And it's like, how are we doing that exactly? Are we, you know, watching some guy look at his phone when he Twitters as he passes a vending machine and then buying a Coke? I mean, how do you know that you've actually produced the sale, you know?
Yeah. Well, awareness in general for a brand is kind of a straw man argument lately, because it is really a concept that can't be measured, but that is clearly, I guess, from a qualitative level, from a wisdom level, like we can talk about how if you don't know a brand, you're not going to buy it. If you're not reminded of a brand, you're not going to buy it. But it's really hard to put numbers on the value of that. How much do you know something, right? How heavily do you know what color the sky is? You know, we're all aware of that factor, but maybe some more than others in a way. And in the same sense, you know, I guess, what is the actual impact of seeing a brand impression of Coke? As we're talking about it now, you kind of want one, don't you?
No, I'm drinking root beer. I drink root beer and ginger ale, and I call them soda pop. Yeah, I'm weird. Blame North Carolina.
That's right. I think they called it Coke when I lived. Every soda was a Coke.
Yeah, well, either you're like in Georgia, every soda is a Coke.
Yeah, but in North Carolina, it was pop, wasn't it? Or soda.
Yeah.
People call it soda. Yeah, in Wisconsin and North Carolina, both soda. That's all I drink. Mm-hmm. Not pop.
So where is it pop? Is that Stanford? I don't know what to blame for it. So soda pop is how it ended up in my head. I think it should all be. Let's launch a soda pop. Let's just do that. We'll launch a soda pop named Soda Pop.
What flavor will it be? Bubble flavored.
It will be bubble flavored. Yes. And it will have like mother of pearl coloring. It will be awesome.
That either sounds really cool or horrible. We'll call it unicorn milk flavor.
Yes.
So I had a couple other notes, a couple other things I wanted to talk about. Did you see this thing about JCPenney, what they're doing with their sales?
They're going to redo everything about JCPenney except what they're actually selling. That seems logical.
Yeah. Well, to catch people up, if they don't know, the guy who basically helped pioneer the Apple Store, this guy, Ron Johnson, and previously he was at Target. So he helped Target turn into what it is now, this whole sort of designer alternative to the big box store. Or you could just say he brought taste to Target. He helped launch the Apple Store with Steve Jobs and, again, brought taste to computer retailing where there wasn't any. And it seems like – so he left Apple a couple years ago to take on the position of the CEO of JCPenney. And it seemed like the idea was he was going to bring taste to that, and that was the problem, right? That's what was missing. And by taste, I guess – I don't know what I mean by that. I guess it's a considered decision or something. It's the It's being selective in how you present things. It's maybe being more graceful in how you deal with your customers, thinking more about their needs and anticipating what they're going to want. So they made a bunch of sweeping changes, right, to JCPenney's. They rearranged the whole store. They had flat rate pricing, so your jeans would be $30, not $29.99, 30. And the whole premise was they were getting rid of all the ways that stores usually trick people. And one of the big ones that they got rid of and made a lot of noise about was most stores mark things up so that they can discount it back to the regular price. Right? So your $30 jeans say regular $59.99, but you got them on sale for $30. And they literally so they just went back on that and they said, okay, we are gonna do that again. And they released a press release that basically said, we found out that people like to be lied to. We thought they didn't want to be, and we found out, we looked through the press release, and we found out that people enjoy this or they prefer to shop that way. Which I think is kind of, some people, there's people out there who want to, I guess there's a lot of articles that where people want to see him fail in this idea. I'm not sure why you'd want to see one person fail or one person succeed or whatever it is, but I guess the arrogance to think that JCPenney shoppers would want something better and he knew what that would be.
No, I think this is really interesting about the price. When I read that too, it's like I'm surprised that people want to be lied to because it bothers me when I see the 9.99s. I have to like mentally go 10 bucks.
Yeah.
Does it bother you?
Well, I mean, I think it's just part of the whole generalized idea that somehow we're so used to getting lied to when we're making purchase decisions that are just by business at all, that it's almost weird to hear the truth. It's almost confusing and it gives you cognitive dissonance in the way that lying normally doesn't, right? Like if you really believe in somebody and you trust them all the time and then they lie to you. You feel that mental pain. But I love that term, cognitive dissonance. But I mean, I don't love the term. I love
Yes.
what it. I love the concept of it, because that's basically what we all trade in an ad thing is like changing people's mind about something in a not painful way. Whereas
Yes.
cognitive dissonance, I guess, is the idea. It's that happening and it being painful. Like when you love George Bush and then you heard that the Iraq War was a scam, you're like, no. Like Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader, right? That's the cognitive dissonance moment. Why is there not a better word for that?
I don't know. There should be one that's easier to say. Have you seen this book here? I thought this was going to be appropriate
No, that's perfect.
for your thing. This is The
Yeah.
Psychology of Price, and it's written by Lee Kadlov, who's a clever mathematician, and he's currently touring the world with his book, basically. I think he's touring it because he's also, having seminars and talking to people and just enjoying the hell out of himself because we did have a good time when he was over here. And he gave me this sweet ass book,
Oh, you met him.
and in it, we hung out. We had some dinner actually. So he wrote the world's longest inscription in the book here. It's like it's pretty clever on how prices actually affect the consumer's choices. So if you want to read more about it, you should probably pick this book up. So I'll just repeat the name of it because he's going to love me for it: The Psychology of Price
Oh, cool.
by Lee Kadlov.
Is that the book on the back? Does it talk about the price of movie theater popcorn? I thought one of the books started talking about that.
No, it doesn't talk about movie theater popcorn there. It has a quote on the front, though. The most understudied, undervalued, and oversimplified subject in business decision making, essential reading for almost anyone in business, by Rory Sutherland, Vice Chairman of Ogilvy & Mather. So that's a nice quote to have
Have you ever met Rory Sutherland?
there. No, I don't think so.
No, me
I've seen
neither.
him like at seminars and stuff.
Yeah, I've seen his TED Talk. He's an interesting guy. Yeah, but no, price is interesting. I don't think price was the problem with JCPenney's. I think it was product.
Yeah, I think it's product too. I mean, Target is a great example on his resume of stuff that he's done before because it's clever how it's laid out and stuff. But at the same time, every time I go to Target, I just feel like it's really cheap. That's
For
all
what
I
you get.
that's yeah, I for what you get. But I take away from it like it's cheapness. Like even
Oh.
if there's brand names in it, I'm like it's cheap. But now it feels cheap to me. But then you go to like some other store that isn't as well planned, and you're like, oh, this is what cheap looks like.
Yeah, Kmart. Or it's just like a mess and you don't know what
Yeah,
it is
Kmart
anymore.
is like a bomb fell. It's just
Yeah.
you can't even find anything.
I don't know how they can be. It's funny because, like, how come I can say that knowing that our Kmart here is crappy and you say that and yours there is equally the same? Like, do they have some playbook that says it has to be crappy? Does somebody have to go through and throw stuff off the racks in the morning?
Yeah, and the design of the store is like some random little twirly thing. We just kind of put all the clothes around like this.
Yeah, I wonder if that's part of their mission is like to show to show stuff being purposefully bad so people know that it's cheap. So if I'm a value shopper and I'm not going to expect that Target has a teapot for the same, well, I probably don't buy a teapot. I'm not going to expect that Target has a corn dog maker for the same price that they have at Kmart, right? Cuz they have bigger aisles and I think it's nicer looking.
So value shoppers don't buy teapots. Is that what we learned today? They buy corn dog makers.
No, I bought my teapot at Big Lots. Do you know what Big Lots?
Yeah.
It's like the stuff that Kmart couldn't sell.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I'm below value shopper. No, I'm prejudiced of shopping and pricing strategy. That's the only thing I'm classist about, where people shop.
Yeah.
I don't get it. If there's a Kmart next to a Target, why do you go to Kmart? I don't get
it. Wow, you are classist when it comes to shopping.
I know.
All I know is I never pay full price for anything. So somehow it's like, and it's not like it's on sale or anything. Like today I was at the Getty and I found a piece that I wanted and I show it to them and I'm like, but it's damaged on the back. So do you have any others? And they're like, no, we don't. We only have this one. And, you know, boom, then I get 10% off of it. And I'm just like, then I'll buy it because or else I won't.
So the Getty, I thought, was an art museum.
Yes. I don't even.
So you're just.
Yeah, I don't even pay full price at art museum stores. Just forget it.
I thought you were talking in the gallery area. You just thought it was all shopping. How much for this? How much for this Monet?
How much for this villa? I like it. It's got a good view.
Knock 10% off and I'll take it.
Yeah, I'd love to carry that kind of cash around.
Yeah.
What else were we talking about? The Google Glasses?
Google Glass, yeah. Oh, so Google Glass did their Twitter thing.
That was interesting. So people had to say what they were going to do with their Google Glass and then they could get one.
Right. And there was a little bit of conspiracy that some of the people who got one tweeted really dumb things or, you know, porn things or whatever. And Google basically just accepted everybody in that program. So it wasn't run how they wanted to run it. But so as a developer, though, I mean, the whole point of it was to get developers on board to make software for it. And you still have to pay extra for this thing. It's $1,500. Which to me, we have some development kits here that we've paid $1,500 for that I absolutely value. And I think it's a good deal in that case. I don't know. You know, we didn't get any hardware for, the Unity toolkit they used to make 3D games. That was $1,500 and they didn't give us anything other than a download. So I guess on the one hand, you could say you're getting the glass with it. I think that Google, I almost feel like, they're unclear themselves of what this thing is in terms of the way that they've been talking about it. Do you have a sense of where they're going with it?
Well, not really. I think no, it's difficult to say. I mean, what I find really interesting and what I've been looking at is how perceptions of Google has changed. You know, the fabulous company that everybody says don't be evil about, and they think it's great and they love Google. And previous stuff they came out with, it's like if they're was Wave, everybody's begging for an invite. If there was Buzz, everybody was begging for an invite. Gmail, everybody's right. Begging for an invite. And now it's just like, people are actually banning these glasses from cafes before the glasses are out. People are very concerned about their privacy all of a sudden, just out of nowhere. And it's funny to me because it's like, you're already pretty much giving away everything you do every day to Google. And now you realize you're doing that.
Right.
So well, it's like, it's not the glasses that are going to make it worse. It's you're already doing it anyway.
Right.
I just find that interesting.
It's just, if you can see it made visible to you, if you can actually like touch it, feel it, hold it, then it feels more obvious. Or, you know, maybe the thing with the glasses too, is you're not sure when they're on or not. Or the email, you know, it's kind of happening in the background.
Because they've seen like previous mistakes, like Google's mistake of the app sales of the Play Store. It tells that app creators my address and my name, and that's none of the app creators' business just because I bought an app from them. So they've had some security issues or privacy issues throughout, and plus that whole thing where they started marrying all the accounts. So if I'm prancing about with my Gmail and I suddenly hit YouTube, this is like the 700th time they're insisting that I start using my real face and name on YouTube. I'm like, I don't want to. How many times do I have to tell you this?
You know, I don't want people knowing what videos I've seen.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I don't want that either. I mean, if I'm, you know, clicking heart on 2,000 million cat videos, you know, you already know I'm the crazy cat lady. So
that's fine. I click on all the how to have rock hard abs ads that are always on my YouTube. I'm embarrassed that somebody would know I watch all those videos and still my stomach looks like this. That's why I don't want people to know. But so the interesting thing, there's two interesting things about glass. So the first thing I think is, do you know who Dalton Caldwell is? I didn't until this week, but he's a guy who started app.net, which I also thought it was kind of the alternative Twitter, just a Twitter that you can pay to use. It's been around for about a year, and they started on sort of like Kickstarter. They did their own Kickstarter, so they were funded by groups, and I guess it's a Twitter of people who want to pay $50 a year to be on Twitter, and they have about 30,000 users. So I'm not on there.
It's not 50. It's $5 a month, so it's not $50.
It used to be. Now it's 36 a year, and then they just opened up a free version. He's been on a bunch of podcasts lately, talking about his vision of it, which is very different than, again, kind of how it was portrayed. But the idea is cool. It's that you have your own social graph that you can take with you to a bunch of different apps, right? So you invest all your time in Facebook, uploading pictures, whatever, making your friends. You want to be able to port that to Vine, or you want to be able to port that to Instagram, so you don't have to refriend everybody, and so that those friends can now see access to the stuff that you had on Facebook, right? You mm-hmm. can't do that. And in fact, Facebook really doesn't want you to do that. They want you to go to their server and look at their ads when you want to look at your pictures, right? Because they're free, they have an anti-user motivation. So there's a trade-off. Because it's a free service, they have to do things that aren't always what the user would prefer. And I think that's what happened with Google too, or why we're getting suspicious with Google, is it was all free. I have no idea how Gmail is paid for, right? I've never paid for it, and they're giving me 10 gigs, and I really like it, and it's a good service. They must be making money somehow, probably in a way that I don't approve of, right? Because I'm not seeing it. And so, in generally, if I did know, I would be kind of like, ew. And I think with Google Glass, it's like, wait a minute, this isn't just going to be in my email. What are you going to be making money from in my life? And what are you going to do with my life and the information that I'm sharing that I might not agree with but never know about? You know, it's bad enough that we have credit reports now. Think about the other kinds of information that companies may want to judge
us. Like how often I'm buying popcorn on a Friday night.
Yeah.
And talking to the cashier about my cat, which is exactly how I spent this Friday.
See, not everybody knows.
Underscore what a loser I am.
Not everybody knows. You didn't need Google to tell everybody that.
No, I'm freely sharing here. Sharing is caring.
So I have a crazy...
No, but it's interesting that the AppNet thing, it's interesting that I've seen several incarnations of this idea recently of keeping your own social graph and your own data. And there's a very good point in that. Like one of my good friends is a programmer and one of the inventors of the sort of database graphing language Neo4j. And since that can traverse like 10,000 steps second, you can do amazing stuff with it. So what we used to talk about a couple of years ago was how our phones could be our servers and our centers of our lives. So I could, on my phone, set up, I'm friends with you, and I want you to see my kid pictures, because that's cool by me. You know, so, but I'm controlling it over on my phone. It's not like I have to go to LinkedIn and get the data of all my friends. I have it on my phone already, and I control this server, and as long as this phone is on, it's my server of my social graph, and you can come and see my kitty pictures, but only while I'm on. And so, and I'm not like putting my kitty pictures on your phone, and I'm not putting my kitty pictures on a third party website.
Right.
And I think that's a really interesting idea, because a lot of people are concerned about this now. But the question is if the people concerned about it are aware of how to solve it. I mean, they really have to step off of Facebook and Twitter in the first place, and they're not doing it. I mean, I killed my Foursquare and I killed my Instagram, and I would be very happy to kill my Facebook, but I have to run some stupid Adlam page, so I can't. So that, you know, it's because I'm guarding pages. I'm always on these places. I don't really care for them myself.
For the connection with the people that you've missed?
Yeah, no, I'm not so keen. I see what people are doing on Facebook. I see people sharing a lot. Friends of mine share a lot. And I'm just like, I put up memes. I'm just like, it's not actually my life on Facebook. Because if you want to talk to me about my life, we're going to be doing that over email or telephone if you know me, you know?
Right. You'd rather have an actual. Well, see, that you're maybe in a little bit of a different situation than the majority uses. Like, most of us don't have 40, 50,000 followers, you know? Like, maybe you're over-socialized online compared to, you know, or all those are overwhelming because I kind of use Facebook with my friends I can't get on the phone with, I guess, or something.
Yeah.
But I totally see where you're coming from. We ran into a weird privacy thing too, exactly what you're saying with kitty pictures, where we are foster parents, and there's a lot of confidentiality stuff around that, right? So my mother-in-law came to visit, and obviously she knows our foster son, but and so she might be interested in seeing pictures of what we did on Easter, but I can't post that to Facebook because of confidentiality for him. I can't share a photo of him publicly, and I don't want to risk putting it on Facebook and getting the privacy stuff wrong.
Right. Well, I think that's pretty cool because, you know, so foster kids have more privacy than other people's kids, normal kids. I don't know how to define that. That was cruel, but you know what I mean? It's like, I see some parents they start out posting, you know, the first naked potty sitting, and it's just like, and they continue, and it's like, no, those go in a photo album and you bring them out when the kid brings home the first date to embarrass the hell out of them. That's what you do with the photos. You don't put them on Facebook. You just don't. You know, and I feel that, you know, I just want to stop some of my friends sometimes and go, really? You just posted 250 pictures of your kid. Like, that's, and you changed your own avatar to, you know, them blowing soap bubbles or something. It's like, I realize your kid is adorable and everybody wants to see him, but it's a little much for your kid. I mean, I'm just thinking about when he or she grows up.
Yeah, they have no private life, and all these other people know all these things about them. Like, oh, it looks like you had fun at Easter, and the kid's like, how do you know that and why? You know, the kid didn't have a choice to get into it.
It's one thing sharing the holiday pictures, because a lot of people used to do that anyway. You know, you'd go to maybe the famous Kmart and get a picture of you wearing a Santa hat, you know, and you send that to everybody you know, right? So I understand that tradition, and I fully expect to see everybody's kids in Christmas and maybe an Easter or a Thanksgiving one, you know, the major holidays, but I'm seeing everything about everything, and it's just like, at some point I need my friends to know that I don't want to know this much about their children.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you feel like marketers want to know what you're doing every time at all the time? You know, there's always this talk about with Facebook that they and Google Glass and other data collection sources, whatever, that information is so valuable because it allows people to market to you better. I've never been on that project, I guess, or I've never had that client assignment that said, get me people who have 3 to 4 kids that got Easter eggs on this day at this time, you know, like that is that oddly specific as far as what people are worried about with Google Glass, you know. People,
the thing
who
I worry about with Google Glass is the same thing that you were mentioning earlier. People don't know if it's going to be on or not when it's not on. We just don't really trust them. That's the problem. There's been a major shift in the brand image of Google, and now they are not to be trusted, according to a whole bunch of people. But it's also, if we're thinking about what we're doing, what people are Facebooking everything about their kids, with Google Glass, you know, there's going to be hundreds of parents taking very lazy kid films because it's so easy to say glass, take a picture, glass, film this, you know? And you're going to be able to find so much information about individuals whose parents have had Google Glass in the future that, you know, to look for the bad guys, you no longer have to look in the information that everybody shares. You have to look for the dark spots where there is no information. Those are probably the bad guys up to no good. So it's going to be like weird because people aren't sharing.
Right.
It's like you're automatically a suspect.
Didn't Eric Schmidt have a quote like that? That he said, why wouldn't you want to share everything? What are you trying to hide?
Yeah.
He kind of had it back on people. you know, along those lines, and it's kind of interesting talking about this app.net where you trust people more if you pay for it, because then their motives are clear, right? I trust Dropbox. In fact, we have our whole business on Dropbox because I pay for it. I wouldn't put my whole business on a free service, a free storage solution, right? Because I would imagine the way they're making their money is by going through my stuff. But I think Google Glass, you know, people are talking about it like it's an interface to your smartphone. But I've been doing some looking around and some research in going based on what Eric Schmidt has said. They think that NFC is the next big mega opportunity, bigger than internet search and search ads. And the reason is this idea of the internet of everything. You ever heard about that?
Mm-hmm.
So like that, the mug that you just drank out of, okay? So somehow this only just kind of, I came to realize it this weekend, thinking about this Apple Watch rumor and Google Glass. So let's say that, you know, an NFC tag is a little sticker. You see, it's kind of similar to the thing that alerts stores if you're shoplifting, that little tag that goes in stuff and, you know, they kind of zap it out. That little paper one that goes in bookstores, that's an NFC tag. And they're so cheap that they're almost free. Well, what if you could take an NFC tag and put a scale in that, right? Some kind of micro sensor that could return how much pressure is applied to it. And you put that sticker on the bottom of your milk in the fridge. Okay, so now that sticker has some idea of how much a full milk bottle weighs and how much an empty milk bottle weighs. There is not a lot of technology in that. Okay, it's either just sort of, here's the number, it's on or off, you have a device that reads that to you. But once those things become everywhere, and you have it on everything, and it's not just a sticker you put on your milk bottle, it's built into the milk bottle, there's a huge amount that we can infer about people's lives from that. So now I have usage data on how you drink milk. So it's useful for you, because you can get an alert that you're almost out of milk. It's useful for you because you can...
And it's going to be useful to advertisers because they're going to see, well, she ate all the chocolate. We better send her some tampons.
Right.
But, you know, seriously, they're out of popcorn and kitty food.
No, that's true. I mean, they can see they sell you an ad, and you yourself find it useful because, you know, you can track your own milk usage and not buy as much. That, to me, is useful. And that, to me, is worth the trade-off. Just if I knew, okay, I'm going to buy a half gallon instead of a gallon. I haven't been drinking it. The opportunity for these guys, for Google and for Apple, is where are you going to put all that information together? And who are you going to trust to deliver it to you? And how are you yourself as a consumer going to take advantage of it? So these guys want that information. Obviously, businesses want that. How are these guys going to convince you to start tracking everything in your life in a simple way? So first of all, there'll have to be a few useful applications, and then these smaller ones can kind of get tacked on. But the first few key ones, like the Nike Fit Band, Fuel Band, you know that thing?
Yes.
Like an accelerometer on your wrist. You wear it all the time, and at the end of the day, it tells you what you did.
Yeah.
Or at least what your arm did. And it guesses,
your
what
arm
the rest
might have
of
seen some
doing.
Action. You never
yeah.
know.
But imagine that, you know, so maybe the iWatch is really just a data detector, data collector, right? Because you don't keep your phone with you all the time. You know, you probably, maybe you throw it in your bag, and now it only knows what your bag did. But, you know, you can't use it in the shower, can't tell you how much shampoo you need. You won't take it to the pool with you. So we're going to be voluntarily putting ourselves into sort of this, what had been a dystopian police state, but maybe we want it. Maybe we want to check all
that. Seriously, I'm creeped out. Can we like go back in time? Because I'm a little creeped out right now. It's like when I was a kid, I met the guy who was designing the barcodes. Or he was on the team of the people who were doing the barcodes. And he explained it to me. And he was showing me the barcodes. And he's like, can you imagine? In the future, we're going to have this on every product. We're going to have it on like magazines, on milk cartons, on everything. And it's like, and I'm a little kid and I'm trying to get my brain around this. And I'm just like, not grokking it.
Right.
And then he's like, so, you know, and you can find it in a centralized system. The laser reads it and you can change prices in one place. You don't have to change the prices over the...
on every sticker.
Right. And he was like explaining all kinds of useful apps for it. And it's all happened as I grew up. Every time I see the barcode, I think of that conversation we had and I'm just like mind blown. How could he even think like that back then?
I know. I'm looking around at how many things do I have that don't have that. And I think that's probably where we'll be with NFC too. Like, are you bothered by barcodes now? But then it was probably, some people didn't like the idea, or you just wouldn't believe that it could happen. Like, no, they'll never pull that off.
Yeah, no, there were people like there were designers against it because it's ugly and stuff, and then there were people saying it's the mark of the beast and so
Right.
on. So yeah, the barcode had some backlash, and I'm just fascinated that it's only until recently that you go to Swedish stores that there's digital displays underneath the product. So they literally do change the cost of a product at the centralized computer in the middle of the store instead of going around everywhere.
Well, they don't even change the tag on the shelf.
Yeah, it changes the tag on the shelf from the cash register. And I'm like, he told me that was going to happen, and it only just happened.
Yeah. When was this when you first heard about it?
It must have been 75 or 76.
Oh, like when they were first launching
Yeah.
them. Was that like somebody at IBM or something?
Yeah,
Yeah.
I was visiting him at Triangle Park.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Hey, Kevin.
But I mean, yeah, we are on the cusp of that again, right? And I don't know, maybe we all just grow accustomed to it. But it's interesting how these marketers, my idea, theory, I guess, is that that's what Google Glass is. It's Google's attempt to introduce the interface for that into our lives. And so they're building things for you that you might want, glasses and stuff. And maybe the reason that we kind of don't get it is because having glasses on our head isn't Google's motive. Collecting the data is the motive, right? So they're working backwards, and so they're like, well, how can we make it fun? Versus it doesn't exist just to capture your life for you. And maybe if that was the case, that's not how you would build it, or that's certainly not how you'd market it. But it's almost like this shell around it, which is kind of Google's modus anyway. Google really, and everything that they do on search, it's to sell you AdWords. AdWords is their product. Search isn't their product. And same with Gmail, right? It's so that they can, how can we give you a pretty good email experience? It wasn't that they wanted to save email for the world. It wasn't that they were worried that you and I couldn't communicate well. They wanted whatever. So I imagine with Glass, it's kind of the same thing.
I have to give him props for one. I mean, it's like when Graham Bell invented the phone, he wanted the interface. He wanted to like sort of have this design of how to operate a phone. So you were supposed to pick it up and go, "Ahoy,"
Right.
which of course nobody does. And the only cool way to answer the phone is to say "pronto," or "mushy mushy," you know. But
Only Italians know how to use the phone. Is that what you're saying?
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Italians and Japanese—they know how to use the phone. But so he was coming with this way of interacting with it, which would have been very interesting had it actually worked. But Glass has a way to interact with it because you have to say "Okay, Glass,"
Right.
which sounds like "Okay, computer." And why isn't anybody bothered by that? But okay, it's nice that you have a way of interacting with it, and it's like it's going to be an expression. It's
Yeah.
the lost ahoy, basically.
But you don't know if Ahoy was just cool in 1890. Maybe that's what all the hipsters were saying.
Yeah, maybe it was badass. It was like the hipster thing.
He probably would be like, "Hello, what does that even mean? Nobody speaks that way."
Right.
We say ahoy to hail a friend. Maybe he thought it was for boats. We don't know.
It was because I think his idea was because it's long distance communication. So ahoy, which is how you would be calling each other from a boat, seeing another boat.
Oh yeah,
You
from
still do that.
a ways
Yeah,
away.
if you're meeting other boats, you still holler ahoy. It's
Every time I've ever met another boat, I probably did yell ahoy, just so I
yeah.
could do it
See,
that once.
that's the time you get to do it. So. You get to
Ahoy.
say the funny words for left and right too.
What? Well, we're running out of time. So how do you say good? Oh, you've got a naval themed mug. Look at how you've planned that all together.
Yeah, I've
She's
able
got
to
anchors on her mug. So, how do boats say goodbye as they're passing away?
Oh God, yeah. What do they say? Do they say ship ahoy? No, they don't. I don't know.
I think one of them's dead, so they don't bother.
That was the worst joke ever.
Boats only meet, they never pass. They never separate. There's no friendly way to do it.